Coming to you from the waiting room at your local DMV, it's The Liberal Arts.
A podcast about postgraduate life and the things we would study if someone were paying us.
Please, somebody pay us.
Hello, everyone. I'm Science.
I'm Cleo.
And I'm Rissa.
How are y'all?
I'm here. I'm very tired.
So awake.
We are definitely conscious.
Yep. I had an entire philosophical discussion about that very thing with the people who work at my bank on the way home.
Really?
Yep.
What?
Yeah. That can be my fun fact for the day. Sometimes I have philosophical discussions about consciousness at the bank.
If Wonder Woman isn't a fun fact, then neither is that.
My fun fact today is just a word.
Okay.
I'm going to teach y'all a new word.
Is it Wonder Woman? Because I feel you.
Is it supercalifragilisticexpialidocious?
No. But it's almost as fun to say.
Okay.
What could be as fun to say as that?
Transmogrification.
That's a
transmogrification?
Good one. Transmogrification. Yes. Now we've all said it.
Say it 5 times fast.
Do I have to?
Yes.
What about it? That, you know that that's not a fact, right?
Well, the fun fact is that I read this word and liked how it sounded. And so I decided to teach it to everyone. Transmogrification. Ready for the definition, everyone?
Okay.
This is from the Merriam-Webster Online Dictionary. To transmogrify is to change or alter greatly, and often with grotesque or humorous effects. So not just transfigure something, but make it look really weird.
I feel like this is a word I've known for a while. Like, I don't know.
You know why? You know why you've known it?
Why?
Because it figures prominently in a story arc of Calvin and Hobbes.
Yes, the transmogrifier.
Really?
Okay, I was trying to think. I was like, it's not full metal because that's transmute. Why do I know this word? Yes, of course, Calvin and Hobbes. Yes. Hannah Nestor, did you not grow up reading Calvin and Hobbes?
Sporadically?
You poor, bereft child.
Remind me to lend you every one of them, because I have them
all. My father has the complete collection of Calvin and Hobbes.
Oh, so do I.
They're very good.
Do you know the etymology of the word transmogrification?
Transmute and modification, that's my guess.
No.
Am I right?
I couldn't really... the closest I came was on dictionary.com where it says it was a false Latin. So basically just a made-up word based on Latin.
Fake Latin.
Fake Latin.
There's a lot of fake Latin out there.
I love it.
You know where you can find a lot of fake Latin?
Oh, do tell.
I actually, when you said it features in a story arc, I thought you were going to say this, Science. This word shows up in Harry Potter.
Of course.
Of course.
Speaking of fake Latin.
Yes, speaking of fake Latin. In Chapter 9 of The Deathly Hallows... Deathly Hallows, I'm sorry. My apologies to J.K. Rowling. In Chapter 9 of The Chamber of Secrets... double apologies! Okay, I'm sorry!
Woman.
I quit. Fun fact, I also left the bank asking them for coffee. Because my brain needs it.
What bank is this that you get coffee and talk philosophy? This isn't a bank, this is a cafe.
They didn't actually have any coffee, but Elijah was gonna get me some.
I legit thought you were about to say Elijah Wood.
No, Elijah Wood does not go to my bank, to my knowledge.
I mean, based on the rest of the information I have about this bank...
The entire Fellowship of the Ring walks into Publix to deposit gold at my bank. No.
That's awesome.
No, in Chapter 9 of The Chamber of Secrets, when Filch's cat is frozen by the Basilisk,
yes.
And they find her,
I'm sorry, don't. What did you just call it?
I don't even know. Basilisk. I think I call it a basilisk.
I definitely heard basilisk. I was the tired one in this room.
Oh no. Filch's cat, Mrs. Norris, is petrified by the basilisk.
Mm-hmm. Well done.
And they don't initially know what's happened to her, and Professor Lockhart says, "It was definitely a curse that killed her, probably the transmogrifian torture." Which, of course, it wasn't. That's really my fun fact for today. My brain's not working, and so...
Fun fact, Cleo needs to go read Calvin and Hobbes.
Cleo needs to read Calvin fact. And Hobbes. Everyone should go to my bank because they apparently have coffee. And trivia! And
Elijah Wood, apparently.
And Elijah Wood and J.K. Rowling.
Are you guys ready for the third and final part of A Tourist's Guide to Prohibition?
I am. Yes, I have been waiting for this for so long.
She has been waiting for this very impatiently and excitedly.
One time for gangsters!
When we last left our nation... it was under the thrall of Prohibition, and the crime rate was rising steadily, leading because people were being arrested for Prohibition-related crimes, such as bootlegging and organized crime. And this leads us to gangsters. We cannot begin talking about gangsters without talking about the gangster, Scarface himself, Al Capone.
Yes.
So Al Capone started off as a bouncer outside of a brothel and a, imagine me doing air quotes here, boxing promoter.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. He was a member of the Italian mob at the time, and he took over at the age of 26 in 1925. That's this is in Chicago. Young. It's very young.
Mm-hmm. Question.
Mm-hmm.
How did he get the scar?
It was a fight back when he was a bouncer in a brothel and a boxing promoter.
Uh-huh.
Mm-hmm. Someone just got him with a knife. Ooh, it did wonders for his reputation, though. So, under his leadership, the Italian mob started and expanded a network of illegal distilleries and a rum-running business that basically brought liquor out of Canada.
Nice.
Yes, he started this protection racket where basically the stores in Chicago bought his liquor to sell, or he blew them up.
Oh.
Okay.
Yeah. About approximately 100 people were killed this way, many, maybe more.
Okay.
Yeah. He was famous for saying of his business, "All I do is satisfy a public demand."
Of being not blown up, or...
of the liquor. He was talking about the liquor.
Okay.
Al Capone was famous. He's famous now for being almost Robin Hood-like in how much he cared about his community. You know, the police were corrupt, and even if they weren't, there wasn't much they could do about all of the crime happening in Chicago at the time. So he actually made a point to build up community spaces and... programs for people. He worked in soup kitchens during the Great Depression. He ran soup kitchens for people.
And he didn't blow them up.
Well, I mean, he didn't blow them up in his soup kitchens, no. He also campaigned for more stringent regulations on expiration dates on dairy products, allegedly after he had a family member die from expired milk, which A, ew, is apocryphal. B, is probably not possible.
Yeah, wouldn't you just, you know, hurl?
Maybe.
I mean, how young was this family member to not tell the difference between good and bad milk?
The story goes it was a niece or nephew, but like I said, it's apocryphal and none of it's clear. So,
right.
However, all this having been said, we cannot underline enough that he was a violent man. He was famous for gang fights. His most notorious act was the Valentine's Day Massacre.
So, that sounds terrible.
Right?
It was really bad.
So in 1929, the Irish mob boss, Bugs Moran, was heading to a garage along with a retinue of his people. He went a little bit earlier than the rest of his guys, and it's a good thing he did, because if he hadn't, he would have been gunned down along with 7 of his men by people dressed as policemen. They weren't policemen.
Mm. Yes.
There was never any evidence to connect the shooting with Al Capone, but Bugs Moran said, you know, of course Capone did it. It's exactly the way that he kills people. And it was kind of like a wink, wink, nudge, nudge. Everybody knows that this was Capone. So, you know, he was never convicted on that. In fact, he was never convicted on any crime of violence at all, or even a prohibition violation. Wow. He was so careful that he was never connected to any of the crime that he instigated. They finally got him not on any violence charges or prohibition allegations, but famously on tax fraud.
Wait, is that because it was, like, the IRS doing everything?
Actually, it was the Untouchables that got him.
The what?
But the reason...
Hold on. No.
We'll talk about that.
What?
Yeah, the Untouchables, very good. But no, they got him on tax fraud because, oh gosh, you're gonna love this. Okay, so he never owned any property. He never even had a bank account. However, he did make money, an estimated $100 million a year. And it turns out that based on this court case, illegal revenue is still subject to income tax.
Of course it is.
They got him on tax fraud, and he was in jail for 7 years because he didn't pay income tax on his illegal revenue.
Did you know that there are actually people having not the same problem, but something close, in that businesses that sell marijuana in states in which that is legal are having trouble paying their federal taxes?
Because they're federal laws against weed,
they're federal laws against what makes their income, but they're also federal laws saying they have to pay taxes on that income.
I mean, oh gosh.
They also have to do everything in cash.
Oh my gosh.
Yep.
Even in states where it's legal.
Yeah, I know all this because they did a special on the shops that popped up in Colorado after that was legalized there.
That's hilarious. I didn't know that.
Okay, sorry, but back to the gangsters.
It's all good. Al Capone was paroled after 7 years in jail, but he died later that year of syphilis.
Wow, that was super a letdown.
Yeah.
He died of syphilis? Boo.
Yeah, and actually he had syphilis way back when he was a bouncer.
I don't know.
He refused to take penicillin for it, even though all it would take is penicillin.
I don't understand people.
Nor me. So the next gangster I want to talk about is Tom Dennison, who you probably have not heard of unless you're from Omaha.
I'm not from Omaha.
I am not, and I have not.
So Tom Dennison moved to Omaha as a youth because they had loose regulations on gambling and prostitution.
What a great reason to move somewhere.
This is where a young lad like myself can make a name for himself.
This is the worst.
As he was getting started with his entrepreneurial activities, he actually started working with temperance groups to eliminate saloons, as long as they were the ones he didn't own.
That's funny. How did he keep the temperance people from getting mad at his saloon?
Yeah.
Bribery, probably, but also he had the town government in his pocket. He was a political boss as well.
Boo. Ooh.
Yes. Because of his influence, he kept James Dahlman, who was also known as Cowboy Jim, in office as mayor of Omaha for 8 terms. I would say they were consecutive, but there was one time what Cowboy Jim lost in 1918.
So Dennison, what happened?
Oh, well, Dennison decided to incite a riot.
Oh, my.
Fun. The logical response?
Yeah, of course. Come with me on this twisted path. The newspapers of Omaha started reporting black men assaulting white women.
Oh, Lord.
Falsely.
No, please, no.
Oh, I know. So, Dennison's right-hand man, Milton Hoffman, threw together a mob, whipped them up into a riot, brought them in front of the Douglas County Courthouse, and they attempted to hang the current mayor and killed 3 people, including Will Brown, who was a black man and was lynched.
This is the worst!
It was the worst. They also tried to burn down the courthouse. And you know what's even worse than that?
What?
It turns out that these newspaper reports, some of them were just straight up lies, but others came from Dennison's men assaulting women in blackface.
What?
Yes. He is the worst.
Seriously?
Bad job, Nebraska.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, it was Tom Dennison. It wasn't the entire state. Bad Let's be job, fair to Nebraska.
Tom Dennison.
From Nebraska.
Yeah, other mafia people were cooler, I guess?
Other mafia people were less racist, maybe. Maybe. Oh. And even then. So, he monopolized the liquor scene in Omaha during Prohibition. He ran basically all of the gambling, prostitution, and speakeasy industries at the time. He held the city and state government in his pocket, and he was never convicted of anything.
Wait, the state government?
Oh, yeah. His influence only grew until he died. He died in 1934, a free man.
Wow.
He was 75.
I've lost some faith in humanity now. Thank you.
Yeah. You want to lose more?
Go no. for it.
Would you like to meet Oney Madden, also known as The Killer?
Not really.
Well, too late. Oney Madden was born in England and moved to New York in 1902. After spending a year in a London orphanage, his mom left him there to make enough money so she could send him over, and his brother, I believe. He ended up moving to Hell's Kitchen in New York City, and he joined the Gopher Gang. Side note, you know what's hilarious? The name of turn-of-the-century New York gangs. Are you ready?
I'm ready.
So ready.
The Gopher Gang's nemesis were the Hudson Dusters.
Oh, no.
That yes, there so was fake.
Did they sweep away the competition?
Did they have gun battles?
Sure.
Did
the opportunity if they didn't.
Did they stand on the opposite side of the street and snap aggressively at each other?
Oh, you know, probably. That's what I've learned from Broadway.
Yes.
And they should know if anyone does.
Art imitates life, all right,
right? Are you ready for more?
Yes.
The names of turn of the century. Okay, so these two gangs were known as the Gay 90s Gangs.
Yes!
They were the Potashes and the Boodle Gang.
Yes! Tell me more about the Boodle Gang.
I don't know anything about the Boodle Gang, but I do know that three other gangs in New York City at the time were the Fashion Plates, the Pearl Buttons, yes. and the Marginals.
Yes! That is my gang, the Marginals.
Welcome to the Marginals.
A very posh version of the Outsiders.
Right? This is very good.
As a member of the Gopher Gang from the time he was in his early teens, Oney Madden was suspected of 5 murders by 1910 at the tender age of 18 years old.
Oh dear.
Once he was outside a club and his rival, a member of his rival gang, which you'll remember are the Hudson Dusters, shot him 11 times. And he lived.
Did the guy miss?
No, yeah, like, they did not.
Where in the torso?
Yes.
The thumb?
Like, did he just
in the thumb.
Shoot him in the leg 11 times?
It's possible, but the fact is that he was shot 11 times and lived. He incidentally refused to identify his attackers. He told the police, nothing doing, the boys will get him.
Oh, no.
Wow.
Oh, yeah.
Did they?
I guess they did.
Well, I mean, the gang violence continued between the Hudson Dusters and the Gopher Gang, so I assume so.
Thanks.
He went to Sing Sing for 20 years after killing a guy over a girl, but he was paroled after 9 years, which was a mistake, because during Prohibition, he was a member of gangs that ran Canadian whiskey. He ran the Cotton Club and had part ownership in 20 other clubs.
Wow.
He had this friend named George Raft, who was also a gangster, who later went legit and became an actor. Who
nice.
He actually played a bunch of gangsters, shockingly accurately.
Typecast if there ever was one.
Right, he's so good at getting into character.
Sounds so real.
How does he do that?
Madden left New York City in 1935 for, get this, Hot Springs, Arkansas.
No.
What?
Yeah.
Really?
Oh, yeah.
What did he do there?
Oh, he ran illegal gambling, he bought a club called the Southern Club, he married the postmaster's daughter, and he lived the rest of his life as a free man.
Wow.
This sounds like the really end. Bad country song.
Yeah.
The New York City gangster who moved south to Arkansas.
And then I married the postmaster's daughter.
No, Cleo, please don't ever try to sing fake country songs ever again.
I don't know, I liked it. So, these are some bad dudes. We know this.
Mm.
But they had some very formidable opponents who were lawmen. Let me tell you about Elliot Ness and the Untouchables.
Yes, tell me more.
So Elliot Ness was the leader of an FBI task force, the Untouchables, who were so called because they were above reproach. They were unbribable, they were uncorruptible, and they were tough as nails.
Nice.
At least 8 of the 11 of them were.
Oh, no, that's not a great ratio.
No, but the fact is that 8 of them still were untouchable. The other ones were just fired, I guess. Elliot Ness and the Untouchables led this massive wiretapping... What?
All I could think of was them being like, you've been touched, goodbye. like in the style of, you are the weakest link, goodbye.
Get out, Franklin, you've been touched.
I'm sorry, please continue with the history.
That was very good. They led this massive wiretapping operation in Chicago in an effort to bring down the organized crime there. And they ended up majorly damaging Capone's operation.
Nice.
They closed down a bunch of his distilleries and caught a bunch of his rum runners. Eventually, wow. It was their idea to try him for tax fraud. But Elliot Ness wasn't as fun as some prohibition agents were. For example, Izzy Einstein and Mo Smith. These guys are so great. They were a 2-man team of prohibition agents. They arrested, are you ready for this?
Okay.
Almost 5,000 people.
What?
Yeah. They had a 95% conviction rate, which is insane.
Wow.
And they confiscated, over the course of their careers, 5 million gallons of liquor.
What did they do with
it? Wow.
I mean, they destroyed it, presumably.
Dang.
Presumably. I don't know. No, but I gotta tell you about these guys. They're so good. Izzy Einstein spoke at least 5 languages and could talk his way through 4 more.
That's amazing.
I know. They actually did not carry guns. They stayed completely unarmed. They made arrests with disguises. Some of their disguises included streetcar conductor, gravedigger, fisherman, iceman, opera singer. Izzy Einstein was challenged on this act as an opera singer. He sang an aria in a speakeasy and then arrested everyone.
This is the best. Why don't we have movies and TV shows about these people?
Oh, we do. There have been. They also disguised themselves once as delegates from the state of Kentucky at the Democratic National Convention because they thought people might be sneaking liquor in there. This was in 1924.
Wait, what happened to the actual delegates of Kentucky?
I don't know, but they didn't find any liquor.
Were they bound and gagged in their hotel rooms, or what?
I like the idea of that, but they were probably just, like, hanging out. Like, they were probably in a different part of the convention center. I don't know where they held conventions in 1924. Anyway, probably hotels, right?
I don't know.
Whatever. Don't ask me.
Giant racetracks with no gambling.
Sure.
No beer.
That's... This is the worst convention ever.
I know.
This is the worst.
Einstein would walk into bars, okay, and he'd be like, I'm a prohibition agent. And everybody would be like, no, you're not a prohibition agent. What kind of idiot prohibition agent walks into a speakeasy and declares that he's a prohibition agent? He's like, I'll bet you a dollar I'm a prohibition agent. And everyone's like, all right, fine, I'll bet you a dollar. And he would take bets and whip out his badge and arrest everyone.
This is amazing.
I love him.
They used to time how long it took them to arrest someone. They claimed that they could find liquor in a new city in under 30 minutes. They only filmed once in Washington, D.C.
Wow.
Yeah. The record was in New Orleans. It took 35 seconds.
Wow.
I just like the idea of them, like, stepping out of the cab and someone being like, here's liquor!
Oh no, it's even better than that. They stepped into the cab. They asked the cabbie, hey, do you know where we could get some liquor? And he said, right here! And pulled out a flask.
Perfect. So, I have a question.
All right.
Were these people alive when Prohibition ended, and what did they do with themselves afterwards?
Yeah.
Ooh, it's interesting that you should ask that, because that is the very next thing I'm going to talk to you about. After I mention Texas Guinan, I have to tell you about Texas Guinan.
Please do.
Okay, Texas Guinan. I didn't have anywhere else to put her. I know this doesn't flow well. She was neither a gangster nor a Prohibition agent. But she was an actress and one of the first famous female MCs.
Nice. I was actually about to say that this history was extremely androcentric so far.
Yeah, it's...
I wasn't going to blame you. It's probably the history books.
There's part of it, but also, I mean, a lot of bootleggers were women.
Mm-hmm.
Because they were less likely to be searched. But because they were less likely to be searched, they were also less likely to be caught.
Right.
They were also not involved.
To be mentioned by name.
Yeah, they were not hired as Prohibition agents, and they were not usually majorly involved in organized crime. There are some.
It's one of those things in the history of crime. The people who aren't mentioned are the people who are doing it correctly.
Yep.
Exactly. There's a very good female gangster I could tell you about. She did not figure prominently in Prohibition. Someday we'll talk about her, but not today.
Okay, but this
today
actress.
I want to talk about Texas Guinan. So, Texas Guinan started and ran the 300 Club in New York City. So, this was another cotton club-esque rich club for white folks, but it was famously fun and classy and hospitable. She was most famous for having 40 scantily clad dancers who were all up in your business.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Yeah, people tried to get her on public indecency charges, and she would always claim, like, the club's just too small. Where else am I supposed to put them? She was arrested a few times but never convicted for sale of alcohol. She actually used to say straight up to people, I've never sold an alcoholic drink in my life. Her club became an amazing place to scout dance talent. A lot of dancers in films, especially during the boom of the 30s and 40s, were discovered in her club. She was most famous for walking out on stage and greeting her patrons by saying, "Hello, suckers."
This is perfect.
I have a question.
Yes.
Was that her actual name?
Texas Guinan?
Yes.
It's a great name.
Texas, probably not. Guinan, definitely. And nice. Before you ask, yes, she is the namesake of everyone's famous space bartender, Guinan, of Star Trek Next Gen fame.
Yes!
I'm gonna pretend like I know what you're talking about now.
It's Whoopi Goldberg.
Ah,
Whoopi Goldberg.
As an intergalactic bartender and counselor to space captains everywhere.
So I legit did not know that she was the bartender.
Yes.
I know she was kind of this wise counselor type person, but I did not know she was also the bartender. That's amazing and perfect.
Yep.
So you asked me about the end of Prohibition.
Yes.
So among other things that made the sharp downward turn of the Jazz Age worse, Prohibition was one of them. The economy definitely suffered. Alcohol was this giant industry. I mean, you guys remember how much people were drinking.
Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so making that suddenly illegal was, like, a giant economic bad idea. Yeah, imagine that. Part of FDR's campaign for economic healing included the abolition of Prohibition.
Thank God.
It was that bad. John D. Rockefeller and Henry Ford were pro-temperance before Prohibition, famously so. But during Prohibition, they changed their tune and started advocating for its repeal.
Huh.
During Prohibition, the 19th Amendment passed, which gave suffrage to women of America.
Yay!
Woo!
Yay! And everyone was afraid, like, oh, great, the women have votes. Now they're gonna stop our chances of voting prohibition out. Guess what, though?
Women like alcohol. Said,
where's our booze?
Yeah, all the women advocated just as strongly as men for the repeal of prohibition. They were sick of it, too. Prohibition ended thusly. FDR was elected in 32, and Congress, with his signature, passed the Cullen-Harrison Act, which allowed for the production and sale of small beer, which is like 3.2% alcohol, and also wine. And then later that year, prohibition was properly repealed by state convention, and that's 1933, and prohibition was over.
Yay!
Oh, mostly. I mean, there were still dry counties and states. The last state law actually wasn't repealed until 1966. Who wants to guess what state it was?
Mississippi.
It was Mississippi.
Yes!
We know very well, we all went to a college that was in a dry county up until, what, our junior year?
Yes.
Mm.
So there are still countywide laws. In Louisiana, you cannot get a liquor license if you are running a donut shop.
What?
Yeah, I don't know.
That's very specific.
That's like the perfect combination. Why would you do that?
You can do it anywhere except Louisiana.
In Texas, there's still lots of laws about when you can sell. Like, as I work in a liquor store, we cannot be open before 10 a.m. or after 9 p.m. or on Sundays at all ever.
That's right. The law that says that you cannot sell alcohol on Sunday, that's called a blue law, and 12 states still have that.
Yep.
I think we have one of those. I'm trying to remember. All I know is that my favorite alcohol-related law for my state is we have an open container law where you can have an open container of alcohol in the car as long as you are not the one driving.
Okay. Unless
you are riding in a horse-drawn carriage.
Okay. All right, ladies. Was prohibition a failure?
Yes. I mean, here's the thing. To say it's a failure, you first have to say, what did it fail at?
I was going to say, did it do what it was intended to do? Clearly, no.
No. Was it a bad idea?
Probably. Definitely.
Did we regret it? Yes.
So, death from cirrhosis of the liver, which is often caused by alcoholism, went down 36% in 18 years during Prohibition.
Wow.
Admissions to state mental hospitals for alcoholic psychosis went down 46% in 17 years.
Dang!
Wow.
Get this. Arrests for public drunkenness. Okay, you'd think, yeah, this goes up, right? Because people are cracking down during Prohibition. It went down 50% in 5 years.
What about private drunkenness?
Well, there's not good statistics on
that. Yeah. No, what I want to know is like I said, did any of this stay down after it was, you know, okay to drink again?
It did. All of it did.
Wow.
How much is
that? That is impressive.
How much is that attributed to cultural change, and how much is that attributed to things like the FDA cracking down on ingredients?
I'm very glad you asked that. None of it is attributed to the FDA cracking down on ingredients. They did most of that during and immediately after the Gilded Age.
Okay.
But a lot of these social changes started well before Prohibition went into effect.
Interesting.
Mm-hmm. Attitudes toward alcohol grew hostile. People were basically like, being drunk is not just a thing that happens, it's a bad thing and a shameful thing. How dare you spend your family's bread money on beer, that kind of thing. So these changes were already coming into motion by the time Prohibition was signed into law. So, was it a success? We're still feeling the impacts of Prohibition. A lot of people replaced liquor in their lives with things that were legal and more fun and also more dangerous, like cocaine. Opiates.
Not great. Okay.
Kind of thing.
Fun. Yeah.
This stigma of liquor, the social change that precipitated most of the good effects of Prohibition, gives it a dangerous reputation, which ends up coming through in America's weird residual party culture that's like leftover jazz age stuff. It contributes to the way American teens drink, making alcohol this dangerous, forbidden thing, you know, that kind of thing.
Yeah. How our the age to drink is higher here than it is in other countries.
Exactly. Yeah. Drunk driving is, of course, still a problem in our country, although it's hard to say whether it's more of a problem here than in other countries. I read an article saying that drunk driving is chronically underreported in Europe, so it's hard to say for sure. But 30% of car accidents in the United States are caused by drunk driving. This is actually better than we've been in the past. In the 50s and 60s, it was 50%.
Ah, ooh.
Dang, 50%.
Yeah. Yeah, the stigma also means that people seek alternatives. We have a serious problem with opiate abuse in the United States, especially in the Midwest and Appalachia. And
didn't
some
actually
of it's,
know that. Oh, yeah.
Yeah,
it's bad.
It's bad. It's very bad. And some of that stems from the stigma because it's better to be a pill popper than a lush.
Mm.
Although, and this is something that I was very interested to learn, alcohol companies started to fight that stigma through advocating responsibility. Now, I thought it was a government regulation thing that, you know, everyone has on their thing, you know, enjoy Bud Light responsibly.
Yeah.
You know, that kind of thing. But it turns out that alcohol companies got together and wrote a code of good practice in 1933 to present. Signing the code was completely voluntary, but a lot of people signed it. As early as 1934, Seagram started running ads about responsible drinking.
Dang.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. Some of these Seagram ads are very good. Can I read you some?
Yes.
This is from 1934, immediately after the repeal of Prohibition.
Okay.
We who make whiskey say, drink moderately. Drinking and driving, do not mix. Or my favorite
one. I like
one,
this.
We don't want bread money.
Ooh, that's good. They're doing it right.
They're doing it right. And this was Seagram in 1934. Since then, alcohol companies have been on board with this kind of thing. They want people to drink responsibly because they know that people not drinking responsibly gives them a bad name.
I like that.
Yeah. I am not here to talk policy. I'm not qualified to do that, but I feel like we gotta learn from Prohibition. Like, you'd think we'd learn that straight-up fear-mongering and banning and prosecuting only does so much to decrease the use of a substance.
True facts.
Mm-hmm. You would think.
In fact, cultural change has proven much more effective. Actually, another good example of this, in 1964, 42% of adult Americans smoked.
Mm-hmm.
In 2016, it was 15%. Do you know why?
Because there was a big campaign against it?
Yeah, Surgeon General warnings and a big campaign. It was a cultural change.
And I can tell you this, that a lot more people smoke in Europe than they do here.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. So I think, you know, like I said, I'm not here to talk policy, but what comes to mind is, like, marijuana regulations?
Mm-hmm.
Like, ruining someone's
that's
life
what I was
over...
gonna say.
Yeah, ruining someone's life over a marijuana possession charge. I mean, we've seen
not
historically
great.
How that works out. It doesn't. What's better is, hey, you know how marijuana makes that part of the brain that's responsible for memory just collapse in on itself?
I didn't know that.
No.
Yeah, it did. Neither. Don't smoke marijuana, kids.
I mean,
this
I'm not
my
one
public
to,
service
but I didn't know that.
Yeah, well, also don't smoke marijuana because I'm very allergic to the smoke. I'm just really allergic to it. This has been a tourist guide to Prohibition. Thank you for coming with me on this weird history journey through my favorite piece of American history.
Thank
this
you for
fun.
Being our guide.
Yeah, oh, and course. Especially for really providing some perspectives on all this. Other than me and Cleo just being like, this was a bad idea.
Yeah, well, it wasn't a super good idea, but the fact is that everything is more complicated than it seems. Imagine that. The world is complex, and anyone who tries to oversimplify it is probably wrong.
I legit thought you were going to say it. Anyone who says differently is selling something.
Also accurate. So, Rissa, do you have a post-grad problem for us?
Yeah, I do. And this is one of the real, like, honest-to-God post-grad problems I've come across. I haven't been dealing with this too much this week, but just kind of in the past couple months, I suppose. I find that I am either underqualified or overqualified from literally everything. And it's weird. Mostly I've been dealing on the overqualified side because I work at a shop and I have a master's in philosophy from Oxford now. And so, like, I got an email from the alumni people, really nice, And they were like, hey, we're checking in with all of our alumni, and we'd love to hear about any programs or publications or whatever you're doing. And I was like, okay, well. And I ignored the email for a while. And then eventually I emailed back and I was like, so here's the deal. I'll tell you. You guys probably don't want to post it anywhere. I work at a shop. That's it. I haven't done anything else. And they were actually really nice about it. Like, they we talked about, like, how I might try pursuing a teaching job and how I might look into publishing and stuff like that. And they, like, wrote this little draft of, like, here, this is what it would be like if we posted on the site. And it was actually pretty nice. But it was just that feeling of, like, well, I got the degree and then I didn't do anything with it. So, yeah, and just, I don't know, being overqualified, but having nothing to do at your qualifications, and then, of course, there being things to do over your qualifications. Mm. And it's just weird, and I feel weird, and I don't know how to feel about, like, it seems really prideful to just be like, I'm overqualified for this job, but I am, like, objectively overqualified for this job. But then there's the thing of, like, I'm overqualified for it. That doesn't mean I'm good at it. You know what I mean?
Oh, yeah.
It's one of those things. It's like, I know a lot in area A, and that means I'm overqualified for a job in which I would need to know a little bit in area B. But I don't know anything in area B. And it's just very strange.
Cleo, you've been going through something similar, right?
Yeah, and some of it's just like you. I get the alumni notifications. Tell us about all the awesome ways you're using your degree and using your experience and changing the world. And I'm just like, well, today I made some really awesome soup. And it was my day off, and I made soup. And it changed my world. But, yeah, there is that. So, right now, I work at a jewelry store, which is awesome, and I love it, but, like you, all the things that I'm very qualified to do don't mean much in my day-to-day job. I need to know things like, when someone says, what is the clarity of that diamond? I just look at it, and I'm like, it's white.
Yeah, I work at a liquor store, and I don't really drink anything that's not beer or maybe cider. So people are like, have you tried this? And I'm just like, no. Which of these wines is better? I don't know.
And it's forcing me to learn new things, but then at the same time, I feel like all my work experience is so eclectic that I really do try to learn the information that's necessary to do my job, but I'm gonna end up like this really, if I ever do get my dream job of teaching history, I'm gonna be this really kooky professor who's like, well, I'm gonna tell you about the Crusades and about how to melt gold.
Okay, one, you say that like awesome. It wouldn't make you the best.
Yeah, I was gonna say, don't act like this is a bad thing. Also, I love the accent you acquire as old Hannah. No, see, I don't see any problem with that. There's no problem with learning subject area B because you're using it, and I think it's...
I mean, that's
yeah, it can only
podcast.
Improve you later on. But I just meant, like... this was especially bad when I was actively applying for jobs. Like, there was this one job that I was interviewed for and didn't end up getting, and it was one of those, like, yeah, I'm super qualified for this job, except that I'm not at all qualified for this job.
Yeah.
Because it's like, I have more than enough education to get a job of this level, but I've never done this job before, and therefore, it's hard for me to get the job, you know?
Yeah.
It
you
was
know
like.
What this reminds me of?
What?
This reminds me of the way that they assume that if you have a doctorate in chemistry, you automatically know how to teach chemistry.
Yes. Okay. That is one of my biggest frustrations in life so far, is the fact that the qualifications required to become a teacher of a subject do not at all correspond to acquiring the skill of teaching that subject.
Nope.
Mm-hmm.
Like, there are two skill sets, teaching and research. And if you're going to be hired as a teacher, you apparently have to be really good at research, even though you don't use that skill, you use the teaching one. And I just am so frustrated and confused by it.
But if you, like, I've met professors who were terrible at teaching.
Mm-hmm.
But they did it because it was the only way they could get paid to do the research.
Yes. Okay.
This was not one at JBU. I'm thinking of other places. But if you're a professor at JBU and you're listening to this, this does not apply to you. I love you.
If you're a professor at JBU and you're listening to this, can this go on our alumni summary?
Yes.
The things that we're actually doing.
Please? I mean, I actually did. I told the Arstrid alumni people about our podcast, so that's fun.
Yay! Thank you.
They have that now. No, but yeah. Everyone at Oxford, so in Oxford, terms are only 8 weeks long, which is really short. It means if there is any seminar, there are only 8 sessions of that seminar. And the joke has always been that this is not to allow students to do their work, it's to allow professors to do their work. No, but anyway, just in general, this idea that you're, like, technically overqualified, except that you don't have the skills to do the job, is weird.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know what to do with it, and I don't know how to fix it. And, yeah, so for now, I've kind of just accepted this, because my job is temporary, and it's kind of like a until the new year for the holidays type of job, I've kind of put this on the back burner.
Mm-hmm.
But as far as getting other jobs, like, I actually got to go to a training session for people who are in the onboarding process for becoming substitute teachers at a public school. Cool. And it's the exact same thing. It's like, unlike most of the people in this room, I have a master's degree. Unlike most of the people in this room, I have never taught a child or been in a public school classroom ever in my life.
I forgot, you've never been to a public school.
I have never been in a public... The only time I have ever set foot inside of a public school classroom was to take the SAT and to take the ACT. That is all. I don't know how classrooms work, you guys!
Yeah, the first time I set foot in a public school classroom was as the substitute teacher.
See, that's gonna be me, like, new year.
The first time I set foot in a public school classroom was as a terrified 14-year-old flute player at band camp.
That's adorable.
You're adorable.
Y'all want to know some things? I can tell you some things.
So, yeah, it's one of those things, though. Like, I am, like, on paper, as far as my actual education goes, more qualified than, I want to say, most of the other people who were there for the training day. But all of them have done so much more teaching and interacting with children and interacting with the public school system than me. So, like, they're more qualified. And it's just weird that we have these two different things, and I don't know what to do with it.
I feel like the key here is to keep things in perspective. Like, be very aware of the reality of your skills, which you're already there, I think.
Yeah.
You know exactly where your skills are and how far they extend, but also not to be ashamed of the job you have to have right now, or ashamed of what you're doing.
I think that's the other thing I wanted to mention, was just this feeling of, I know how much it took for me to get this degree. I know how much money it took. I know how much time and energy it took. Mm-hmm. I know how much I had to go through to get this degree. And so not using it feels like such a waste. It feels like a shame to just not use that degree.
Almost like you're letting people down.
Yeah, like I'm letting people down, like I'm letting my past self down, maybe my present self down, I don't know. But then it's like, that doesn't feel like a super healthy attitude to have.
Keep in mind, just because you're not using it now doesn't mean you're never going to use it.
True. I don't know. I think it's just because I'm in a field where there's very little way to use a master's without acquiring a PhD.
That's true of every field.
But I think that's my main frustration, really. It's one of those things. It's like you can't teach philosophy in high school. That's not a thing. So, and they don't really hire you to teach undergrad until you have a PhD.
What even is the use of a master's degree? I have a friend who is finishing up her master's in chemistry, and she's applying for bachelor's level jobs, jobs she could have applied for 3 years ago.
Yep.
Like, because nobody cares that you have a master's degree.
That's true.
Something. What is the... If you know the use of a master's degree, listeners, please write in and tell us.
Yeah, especially ones in philosophy, history, and chemistry.
Yes.
I mean, this is why I'm going straight for the doctorate, man.
Yep.
I will say, if you do the substitute training, I had to do the substitute training, and I don't know what your program is like, but they put us through a whole series of stuff on classroom management. And just...
Yeah, they gave us a talk on that, but I mean, it was kind of a talk.
I'll have to see if I can still find my stuff, because I honestly still use that stuff, like, every day at work.
The substitute teacher training in Tennessee is much better than the substitute teacher training in Texas.
I mean, I did it all online. I never set foot in a classroom. Until basically my first day I went into, like, the one-day orientation, but... It was a lot of just personal interaction skills, and it focused more on how you respond to things.
Interesting.
And just getting yourself in the right mental place. And I used it at Disney a ton. Hmm. I mean, I use it when I'm dealing with customers every day. It's very good.
Nice. It sounds like, you know what it sounds like?
What?
It sounds like hostage situation training, is what you're describing. Which is kind of true, because I know what middle schoolers are like.
Yeah.
We were talking about how, as a sub, I'd probably be able to choose whether I wanted to take on more high school, middle school, or elementary classes. And we were talking about the kind of pros and cons of each, and how, well, this one is kind of a shorter session, but more of them, and this one is, like, an all-day thing. And we were talking about how when you get too low, it stops being a classroom and just starts being crowd control. And
yeah.
I don't think anyone could pay me enough. And I don't think anyone wants me to be an elementary school teacher.
The thought of you trying to teach a class of second graders makes me so happy.
I couldn't even, like, I wouldn't even know what to do with them. Like,
I would pay good money.
What do you do with children?
I would pay good money to see you in the kindergarten classroom.
Do you know what's funny? I actually have assisted kindergarten stuff before, mostly at, like, church daycare stuff. Kindergartners like me.
That is funny.
It's because you treat them like what they're saying is important and valid. Yeah, you treat them like humans, whereas
they're just
most
small people.
Yeah, exactly. Most people treat children like they're animals, and that's just...
That's true.
Yeah, which, with middle schoolers, you're not far off. But they are humans, you know? They're just humans.
Actually, someone encouraged me to try starting with middle schoolers as opposed to high schoolers.
Mm-hmm.
Especially sixth graders.
Sixth they were like, graders yeah, are...
Sixth graders are actually the nice, because they're still scared of you.
Yeah, they are. It's true.
I was like, okay.
Excuse me, Miss Willis. Can I go to the bathroom? Our hall passes that lizard.
Yes, here. You must hold the living lizard the entire time you're in the bathroom. If it falls down the toilet, you cannot come back.
Until you get it out.
Oh, Lord.
I can just give you one big piece of substituting advice.
Yeah?
Don't send the kids to the bathroom at the same time.
Yeah, no.
Hmm. Okay.
So what are you into, science? Anything good?
Well, I'm glad you asked.
Anything exciting?
Yeah. A little bit exciting.
So a little bit. You've been talking about this for, like, months.
Yeah. So, I don't know if you've heard, but if you listen to any podcast at all, including this one, you may have heard of a little thing called PodCon. PodCon is the podcast convention. It is the first of its kind. It's taking place in Seattle this weekend, and I'm going.
Woohoo.
I'm going to that.
The others of us are not going.
We're not.
Because we don't live anywhere near Seattle.
Alas, Cleo and Rissa cannot join me, but I am so excited. There are going to be live shows that I am extremely pumped about, like Sawbones and Alice Isn't Dead and My Brother, My Brother and Me.
It's extremely exciting.
Oh, yes. I won the signing lottery for Still Buffering, which means I get to meet my hero, Dr. Sydney McElroy.
Nice.
And tell her.
Wait, you didn't tell me this.
Did I not?
No.
I'm so sorry. Yeah.
I have gotten zero information.
I didn't know it was for Still Buffering. I thought it was for Sawbones.
I wish it was for Sawbones, because then I could tell Justin McElroy that I love him, which would be awkward in front of his wife. Anyway, it's for Still Buffering, which I also very much love. I am a big fan of Taylor and Riley Smurl. But Dr. Sydney McElroy is, of course, as a fellow scientist and a woman and a leader who is highly respected in her field, my hero, and I get to meet her and tell her that, and I am extremely excited.
She's also just lovely and also hilarious, so.
Oh, it's so true. I love her. I love them all. I am pumped out of my mind. There are going to be workshops, there are going to be panels, there's going to be networking, which I'm not going to lie, I'm a little bit terrified about. But my friend and mentor, Connie, has helped me through some of my fears with that. So we've got cards with the name of the podcast on it that I am going to give to people like an actual professional.
You're amazing. And then you can come back and tell us how to make a podcast.
Yeah.
Finally.
We need all the help we can get.
17 episodes in, we're finally going to know how.
No, at any rate, if you, our listeners, are going to PodCon, you should definitely email us or tweet at us or something and let us know. We would love to meet a listener who is not in our immediate friend group.
And not our moms.
And not our moms. If you'd like to contact us and let us know that you'll be at PodCon, or to tell us what jobs you are over and underqualified for simultaneously, you can reach us at theliberalarnts@gmail.com or on Facebook, Tumblr, and Twitter as The Liberal Arnts. And we love you.
Also, we love you.
And we do.
If you wanted to leave us a rate and review on Apple Podcasts, that would be so choice. We have exactly one.
Yes, for which we are very grateful. Thanks, Dylan.
But, yeah, thanks, Dylan. So, thanks to Caitlin Thompson for our graphics and design, and Tristan at Vintage Lab Tech for our music. And also thank you to Justin Kirkpatrick for our opener. He suggested that. You are also welcome to suggest openers for us. We open every show with a different place we are coming from.
If you haven't noticed.
Yeah, if you hadn't noticed the last few episodes or so.
Shout out to my bank. For philosophical discussion and twirling, because that happened too.
Okay, we're gonna go before this bank gets any weirder, I think.
Thank you for listening, and until next time, learn something worth knowing.